Hi. How are you guys? The ushers are going to come forward. If you came prepared to buy me a new stool. I'm not sure this is safe. We're going to give it a shot. Let's see if we can't make a memory. You'll know if God's not behind about what I'm about to say. The ushers are going to come forward. What they're doing is, if you came prepared to partner financially with what we get to do together, what God's doing not only for us but through us and with us locally, globally, day in and day out. If you came prepared to do that, that's what the bag going by with handles is. A couple of other little things to talk about while that's happening. Get asked about communion oftentimes, the celebrating of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. And the bread, the elements of the bread and the cup, and that remind us of the broken body and the spilled blood of Christ. The followers of Christ have been doing this for thousands of years. Oftentimes we'll do it together corporately on a Sunday, but every Sunday it's available through those back doors. There's a room back there that's hopefully a little bit quieter, so you can think and go back there with somebody else and celebrate what God is doing in your life, or maybe just to ask, what are you doing? I'm trying to find you in my life, and just to have that space. And then our life groups that meet all over town in people's homes throughout the week, that's also a big place where you'll have a dozen or so people gather together and sometimes take the elements and remind each other of the story that we're all part of. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, every once in a while, right here on the screen, you'll see a little code, a couple of letters or a couple of numbers, something like that. And if you don't have children, that looks like a secret handshake you're not part of. It's nothing as exciting as that. I just want to let you know that that code, when that comes up, if you're the uninitiated, all that means is, when somebody has brought their children over to our wonderful children's ministry and that child decided, you know what, we're going to do this differently. We've got a great team over there. But ultimately, sometimes the child just really has other ideas. And so we come get the parent or guardian. So when that code goes up, we're not trying to say anything esoteric. Just watch, and somebody will sheepishly stand and shuffle toward the door because their break's over. All right. See, what else we have? I think that's it. We're in the book of Mark, so thought we'd try that today. Going through everything Jesus said in the shortest of the four gospels, and the context into which he is speaking. So everything that Jesus says in the book of Mark, we're going through. And we're going to make a lot of ground today in the 11th chapter of Mark. But what I'd like to do first is, I'd like to go backward in time, even before the setting that will be depicted in Mark 11. And today, I want you to know, and I warned first hour of this, and when I was finished, I realized I didn't warn them sternly enough. This isn't a very good sermon. What I'm going to do is pretend like there's 11 or 12 of us in the room, and we're just going to talk. We're going to have a Bible study together. I think I'm going to provide a lot to think about. I'm going to zigzag a lot, and if I have time, I may even zig again. But there's a lot going on in this, and I think it has huge ramifications for not only our understanding of what Christ was up to, but our understanding of our life. Like, what are we supposed to do with it all these years and all this geography later? The other thing, just as a kind of a disclaimer up front, is I want to be so bold as to tell you, I don't do this often, I want to tell you that what we're going to get to in the 11th chapter of Mark, I can tell you exactly what Jesus Christ was thinking. I can't often do that. I wouldn't claim to be able to do that often. But in this scenario, I think I can tell you exactly. That is, we can know exactly what Jesus Christ had in his brain when this episode unfolds. But to do that, I have to go about 750 years before Mark 11 happens, to give a little context. Understand that Jesus was Jewish. He came from the Jewish tradition. Jesus was not a Christian. Jesus was a Jew. And so to be Jewish, I want to step carefully here, because, frankly, I'm Irish and I live 2,000 years later on the other side of the planet. But to be a Jewish man or woman in antiquity was really, in the truest sense, it was to be special, because you've been specially chosen. You know, the Jews, the Hebrew people, They didn't have an inheritance. Their inheritance was God. They were the Hebrews, by very definition of that term, they were wanderers. That their charter was to put God on display. This is what human beings living in the ways of God look like. This is the salt of the earth, light of the world kind of living. And so it was an extremely important mantle that they carried. To be a Jewish man or woman was to accept the responsibility that you and generations after you, your progeny, were ultimately leading to Messiah, HaMashiach, the king that would restore all things to himself. And so this is a huge responsibility. And if you read the Hebrew scriptures, or what many of us call the Old Testament, what you find is a group of people and individuals within that group that variously get it right, and then it's a disaster, a complete disaster. And like any of us would do, we have good days and bad days, good centuries and bad centuries. And so it goes up and down, and you variously then have prophets encouraging them, hey, we're under oppression now, but keep the faith. Or, hey, we're the ones to blame, and we're the ones that need the gut check and be reminded of what we're supposed to be doing and where this thing is leading, all of that. The prophet Isaiah, I would argue, is Jesus's favorite prophet. And so his Bible that he grew up reading and listening to in synagogue would be what we now call the Old Testament in large part. And there's an interesting thing that happens in the 56th chapter of the sprawling tome that we now call Isaiah, where Isaiah, as a prophet, is speaking to Israel and calling them into account. Keep in mind, that's what prophets do. Prophets don't stand on street corners and yell at strangers. They inwardly remind the family of what we've all signed up to be. And so the prophet is saying some things to a people that, if we can try to get it in our minds as we're listening to it, who believe that us, we are special. We are the holders of this eternally significant charter. Isaiah says this in chapter 56, "Thus says the Lord." So he's getting ready to quote God. "Keep justice and do righteousness." Now, that's some phraseology that we probably only use in church, kind of lofty language. Let me help you with it a little bit. Justice, in the sense that they're talking about, is pretty much what you'd think. Things being right between people. Things being equitable. People being treated well. People having consequences for their unjust behavior, but that doesn't exceed their behavior. Keeping things, if you think in carpentry terms, square or flush. To keep justice, keep things right. And to do righteousness, that's an English word, of course, translated from the Hebrew tzedekah. Huge word. Has to do with how we treat each other. Has to do with the life that we live before God, which is entirely tied to how we treat each other. Tzedekah is even a word that you would use to describe the way that you treat the poor, the less fortunate, that you would be a voice for, an advocate for those who have no voice, that you would defend the cause of the powerless. That's righteousness, this expansive idea of partnering with God to set things right when they're not. Keep justice, do righteousness. These are sophisticated ways of saying love. Not on a concept or a theory. Love in measurable, tangible ways. Be a people of love. "For soon my salvation," the Hebrew word for salvation is Yeshua. Joshua, we call him Jesus. A little pun there a few centuries before Jesus walked. "For soon my salvation will come and my righteousness will be revealed. Blessed is the man who does this, the Son of Man who holds it fast, who keeps the Sabbath, not profaning it." Blessed is the man that lives in this rhythm, that doesn't get caught up in the rat race, but lives in this rhythm. He keeps his hand from doing any evil, creating victims in any measure. "Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, 'Well, the Lord will surely separate me from this people.'" Wait. Remember, we're special. We're the chosen people. So by definition, foreigners are them. But the Lord says, no more should them say that they're them. You're not separated. "And let not the eunuch say, 'Behold, I am a dry tree.' would encourage you to Google eunuch later if you don't know what that is, but I'll try to catch you up in a family-friendly way. A eunuch is someone who voluntarily or involuntarily, through either the way they were born or an injury, or even having done it themselves, a eunuch is a man that upon physiological examination is missing part of what makes him different from women. Is that, how'd I do? I've been working on that all morning. And so, you don't clap. That's just awkward. Finally, Mom, they applauded. Over what? and so, being a eunuch was very threatening for other people. They didn't know what to do with this person who was physically ambiguous. That you can find all kinds of extra biblical writings on this. They didn't know what to do with them. So what they did, you can even find in the book of Deuteronomy, is to say, stay away. Because we're supposed to be a people whose progeny, whose seed will lead to the Messiah. And you obviously can't participate in that. Stay away. And the law says, the very Jewish law, Torah, says, if you're a eunuch, you have no place in the temple. Stay out. You may not come into the temple. Let not the eunuch, though, say, behold, I'm a dry, i.e. fruitless tree. For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who live in these rhythms, who choose the things that please me, and I think that's better translated, who choose the things that I delight in, the kind of life that I want for you, and those that hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house, you can translate that, temple, and within my walls, a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. Whoa, 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 whoa. But it says they can't come into the temple. You say, you know, does the Bible have contradictions? Yes. Oftentimes they're beautiful. The very people that are them aren't. Don't let them say that they're dry trees. I'm going to give them something even better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Who says the Bible doesn't contain humor? And verse 6, the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister or to serve him, to love the name, the reputation of the Lord, and to be his servants. Everyone who keeps the Sabbath and doesn't stain it and holds fast my covenant, they're no different. These I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in the house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be just as good as yours. Imagine hearing this. Wait. Then what makes us us? What makes me me if you're saying them too? For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. You can translate that, all nations of every stripe. My house will be called a place of interacting with God, prayer, of speaking and hearing from God for everybody. The Lord God who gathers the outcasts of Israel declares, I'll gather yet others to him besides those already gathered. So there's you and then those that I've gathered. And then like ripples in a pond, I'm going to continue to gather and gather and amass. This thing is going to grow far beyond us. And then verse 9, all you beasts of the field come to devour, all you beasts in the forest. Like, so let's just throw the door wide open. Let's have the animals come in. But this is our pure, clean, no, if it can breathe, let's have it come in. His watchmen, that is to say, the religious leaders, the overseers of this thing, they're blind. They're without knowledge. They are silent, mute dogs. They cannot bark, dreaming, lying down, loving to sleep. The dogs have a mighty appetite. They never have enough, but they're shepherds who have no understanding, no wisdom. They have all turned to their own way, each to his own gain, one and all. Come, they say, let me get wine. Let us fill ourselves with strong drink. Other translations, strong beer. Tomorrow will be like this day, great beyond measure. Some translations say, maybe tomorrow will be even better. Here's what the Lord says. Love to do justice and keep righteousness in your midst, to live this way. This thing is being thrown open bigger, bigger, more and more inclusive. But the people who try to keep us, they're like dogs whose appetites can never be filled. Like all they think about is their own appetites, this insatiable selfishness. This would be a hard thing to hear back then. But it takes us and it helps us understand where we're going to go today in Mark chapter 11. Jesus entered Jerusalem and went into the temple. And when he had looked around at everything, as it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. Verse 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. So that's how it starts. He goes from Bethany into Jerusalem, looks around, looks at his watch, says it's getting late. Let's split. We'll come back tomorrow. The following day, they come to Bethany. Jesus is hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it wasn't the season for figs. And he said to it, like messiahs always do, they talk to trees, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say it. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and he began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. He wouldn't even allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Isn't it written that my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? But you've made it a den or a cave of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it, and they were seeking a way to kill him because they feared him, because the whole crowd was astonished. It blew their minds, his teaching did. Verse 19, and when evening came, they went out of the city, and as they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered." And Jesus answered them, "Have faith in God. Honestly, I'm telling you, I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be taken up and thrown into the sea,' and he doesn't doubt in his heart, but he believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you've already received it, and it's yours. And whatever you stand praying, forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father also is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses, your sins." There's a lot going on here, and there's a lot of weird stuff going on here. What I want to do is I want to back up and I want to start with the temple. I want to go back in. So we're going to start at verse 15 and we're going to make a couple of observations and see if we can't learn something. They came into Jerusalem. He entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. He wouldn't even allow anybody to carry anything through the temple. Now, I want to step carefully into this, but it's generally believed and understood through ancient historians and modern scholarship putting everything together that the system of the temple in the first century was pretty corrupt. It was pretty self-serving. You have, in this time of year, this would be spring, you have the Passover, and you have Jewish men and women descending on this same town, and numbering it hundreds of thousands, coming to worship. And they're coming from all over the known world. And so everybody has a different currency, and they come to make their offerings, and everybody has different coinage. Well, the money changers are like, "We can help you, and here's the exchange rate. It's about $10 to a dollar." We're not talking about rich people. We're talking about people who have to save to be able to travel away from their jobs and to be able to do this in the first place. And then you show up in God's temple and you find that the exchange rate is so inflated, so exorbitant, you can barely get your wallet around it. And then they're offering pigeons. You have to understand that there's a sacrificial system that to atone for sin, you know, it has to cost you something. The whole sacrificial system. And as you've got a herd of sheep, you're not like, "Well, you know, Gimpy back there, he's missing an eye and a leg, and let's go ahead and I'll offer him to God." No, no, no. Best of the best. It's got to count. You got to feel it for it to be a sacrifice. And so it has to be the best of the best. And this is audited by the people who work in the temple. As you bring these animals in and bring these financial offerings in, well, you can imagine how that went. You go into the temple to buy a pigeon to sacrifice. Cost you about $15. But outside the temple down the road, cost you two or three. What do you think happened when you buy a $2 or $3 pigeon and walk it in and show it to the priest? I don't like the right wing on that. No good. God would not accept it. You see, they're tied to the system. It's corrupted. It's become self-interested. So you have money changers and a sacrificial system run from the top down by many people's estimates in a way that doesn't help it become what 750 years earlier Isaiah said it was for. This is supposed to be a hub for everybody. Now, let me give you a little more context, because this will help you understand what's going on. I want to put this map up here. This is obviously a depiction of the temple. And this piece of property takes up about 20 football fields right in the middle of Jerusalem. You can see the holy place, the highest structure there toward the back in the middle. All the way around in that flat space is the court of the Gentiles. Now, anybody could come in and see the architecture. They could come in and ask questions if they could find somebody's ear to chew on. This is a place where anybody could come and maybe take a couple of steps in understanding the Jewish God, Yahweh. So anybody can really walk in this area. And you can see over here in the corner, Fortress Antonia. That's Roman. The Romans are like, yeah, you can have your thing, but we're going to put a tower right here so we can watch. So you guys, if you have a riot, if we're watching, if you guys start fighting, we'll come down there and you guys will regret it. So it's the whole thing's being overseen by the government. This is where Gentiles were allowed to go. Then you can see right here in the middle where it says the women's court. Jewish women were allowed to advance into that next area. Gentiles could not. Right where the court of women began, there was signage that said, if you pass this point, your death is on your hands. So if you're not Jewish, you can't go any further. And if you try to spoil or profane this holy place, you'll be executed on sight. So this is where women could go, but they couldn't go any further than that. If you go further, you can see the court of Israel and then the court of priests. It became more and more elite until you get all the way to the holy place where really only one man one time a year could go, a Levitical priest. And they believed that in that holy place was where God lived. You can get from one side of Jerusalem to the other many ways, but guess what the shortest way across town was? Well, right through here. You can just pass through one of these many gates and cut through. And so it had become quite a problem, so much so that outside the Bible, you can read in the Mishnah that it says you can come into the temple, you just can't bring bags. Because what they're trying to cut down on is people shortcutting through the court of the Gentiles to get from one side of town to the other. So you can come in, you just can't bring your bags. And so if you're trying to cut through, it's like, well, if I can't bring my bag, what's the point? I might as well go around. It had become a problem. Jesus, if you go back to Mark chapter 11, it says in verse 16, he wouldn't allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. Why? He's a purist. He's knocking tables over. He's driving at the money changers. You've got pigeons flying all over the place. Get out, get out, get out. No, no, you put that, go back outside the gate. Get out of here. Jesus is a purist. It's, I believe, theatrical. I don't think he's lost his temper. I think there's a theatrical way of saying, have you guys forgotten what Isaiah 56 said? I know you haven't, because we all memorized it as kids. This is supposed to be a place where even the Gentiles can come into the presence of life himself. And you've turned it into a robber's cave. And there are roads from Jerusalem to Jericho you could barely get down without somebody springing out of a cave to take everything you own, to leave you for half dead. And it's worse here now. Jesus is affirming not just this architecture is really important. Jesus is saying, you've missed your charter, your calling. This is supposed to be a place where them becomes us. And you're taking advantage of them. And you're just letting people just stroll right through. Imagine somebody walking in that door right here and say, excuse me, I just needed to get over here, because they don't value your soul or your walk. Next verse, 19. When evening came, they went out of the city. Why did they go out of the city? Because it's getting very dangerous to be Jesus in town. So he can't stay in the holy city. It has to leave. And they passed by in the morning and they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. This fig tree, by the way, is in the town called Bethany, Bethany, house of figs. And Peter remembered and said, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered. Now, did Jesus curse the tree? I'm not arguing with Peter. That's not how I read what Jesus said. If you really look at what Jesus said earlier, before they got to the temple, when he was hungry and he went to the tree, you know, he seems a little irrational. You know, maybe he's one of those grumpy, hungry messiahs. I don't know if that's how you describe yourself. I haven't eaten, so I kind of lose it a little bit. But if you go back to verse 14, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. This is what Jesus said. He doesn't curse the tree and say, die, tree. What he does, he kind of curses the relationship between eater and fruit provider. What Jesus curses is the overlap between the tree and the hungry people that come to it. And that kills the tree. If I could personify the tree further, you could say that what Jesus maybe tells the tree is, you know, you don't have the market on figs cornered. Because Jesus, by not eating from the tree, doesn't die. Nobody dies not eating from this tree except for the tree. Then goes into the temple and says, did you guys forget? Did you guys become so inwardly focused that you forgot what this place was supposed to be? The tree had leaves. It looked alive. It didn't have any fruit, though. And as many people in the scriptures take pains to remind us, you tell what a tree is by its fruit. And in the same way, this tree doesn't have the market cornered on figs. Maybe Jesus is saying, and the reason that the fig tree episode sandwiches the temple tantrum, maybe what Jesus is saying is, you don't have the market cornered on God. You look alive. There's people and all kinds of stuff happening. But you don't have the market cornered on God. You were supposed to be a means to an end for all nations, and now you've made yourself the point. And so you've got leaves, but you're already dying. So then they leave town. And Peter sees the tree and says, look, a tree you cursed, it's withered. And Jesus, I believe, hoping that they would notice what, in my mind, is an enacted parable. Sometimes he tells stories. I think rather than losing his mind over a shrub, what he's actually doing is theatrically enacting a parable. And so Peter notices and Jesus says, have faith in God. Because truly I tell you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and doesn't doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it'll be done for him. I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. Now, I don't know anybody, it doesn't mean they don't exist, but I don't know anybody that believes if you squint hard enough and really believe, you can upend an entire ecosystem with a prayer. That you can, and it, look, he doesn't say you can tell the mountain and, you toss the mountain into the sea. Actually, it's passive, that you can make the mountain want to do it. I don't know anybody that believes that that's literally what Jesus is saying. It's maybe helpful, this context, to note that there is some evidence that apparently moving mountains is a euphemism that got used a lot back then. There was a man in antiquity about the 3rd century that said he listened to a man by the name of Rabbi Resh Lakish, and he was able to teach things that were so, like, man, we all got tripped up on these teachings, but the way he taught it, the quote is, it was like watching him pluck up mountains. In the Talmud, the most powerful gifted rabbis were said to be those who could uproot mountains. So apparently it was a way of describing how the religiously savvy were able to take complicated things and set them down so that you could actually get at them and maybe begin to understand them. And Jesus says, I say to you, whoever says that this mountain be thrown into the sea, if you have faith, you can do that. Here's what I think is happening. I think Jesus is talking to a bunch of insecure fishermen and tax collectors and scoundrels. You know, people like you and I, saying, you know you can do that. What you think only the superheroes in the temple can do, that connection you think only they have with God, you recognize that you can do that. You recognize that you have direct access to God. You recognize that the fig tree doesn't corner the market on figs, right? Your faith counts. Your belief counts. Your belief is enough. You don't have to stand behind the dam of somebody else's faith. You, scoundrels, I love you, and you have direct access to all of this. But Jesus never does tricks. People ask Jesus all the time, do a trick so we'll know that you're the Messiah. And Jesus says, no, he won't do it. And here's a great example of what's in his head and maybe why he doesn't do it. Because look at the very next sentence. You can move mountains. Your belief, your prayer is powerful. And, verse 25, whenever you stand praying, forgive. If you've got anything against anyone, so that your Father also who's in heaven may forgive you your trespasses. We can move mountains. Tell us how to move mountains. It's like this. While you're praying, forgive. No. The trick. Like, show us how to do the miracle thing. I am. Forgive. Isn't it interesting? Jesus puts side by side mountain relocation and you letting people off the hook. Well, but I want to know how to do the first thing so people know I'm powerful. That's how people will know that you're powerful. That you participate in the ministry of reconciliation. And it's not a dare. If you don't forgive, God won't forgive you. No, it's you're participating in the ministry of reconciliation. You don't get to say, God forgave me, but I still hate you. You're part of a circuitry of reconciliation. Christ is inviting us in to a flow where people let each other off the hook. You can do this. You and I are going to do what you thought was the sole proprietorship of the temple. You can do this. We can, yeah. And while you're doing it, don't forget reconciliation was the point. Righteousness in keeping justice is what God has always wanted. Them is us. God is trying to teach us peace and love all people. Paul picks up on this decades later. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. He says, if I had prophetic powers, understand all mystery, like I'm the guru, I'm the go-to, all knowledge, if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. It's just noise. Make a mountain splash in the sea, but you don't have love and a desire for things to be right between you and all people, as much as is up to you to have peace with all mankind, it's just geographic relocation. Big deal. It would be very easy for us to look at this and say, especially as the trajectory of Mark is getting closer and closer, we're in the final few days where Jesus is going to be beaten and crucified and killed and buried. It'd be very easy to say, okay, so Jesus is basically affirming that we're all the ragtag followers, the irreligious heathens that follow behind Jesus. And so Jesus is the good guy and religion is the bad guy. It would be easy to walk out and leave it there. And frankly, we could go get in our cars and say, man, that Jesus, he was really a likable guy. Man, he knew how to rebel. And there's weight to that. Many of us helping us to think of Jesus maybe as less the lofty, floaty thing that we grew up thinking about, but your friend, your advocate. And we could stop there. But maybe here's that final zig. I think it's a mistake to think of the religious establishment as the bad guys. Like one day they woke up and they went into a back room and started twisting their mustache and laughing maniacally and saying, how can we stick it to all those heathens, all those Gentiles? How can we create a system that defrauds those subhuman creatures? Because remember, their intentions were probably good. They had Isaiah 56 in their heads too. See, I think what happens is it happens in individuals and then it spreads around your kitchen table and then through your city and it becomes from an individual to a systemic problem and pretty soon it becomes the kind of thing that Jesus speaks against and starts upending tables. I think it happens gradually and I think it happens quietly. And here's what I think is one of the main reasons Well, here's why I think it happens. That you and I come from a long tradition of trying to be perfect. Perfectionism is a way of life for the majority of us in the room today. We want to perfect ourselves for our mother and our father, even though our mothers and fathers died years ago, or they live hundreds of miles away. We still have a sense that we're not good enough if we can just perfect, perfect, perfect. We want to be perfect sons and daughters, and we're bitter because we feel like we're not there yet. The standard is a moving target. We want to be perfect for them. We want to be perfect siblings. We want to be perfect employers and employees. Many of us in this region want to be perfect students. We want to raise perfect kids. We want to say perfect things. We want to believe and vote perfectly. Per means completed, effect, let's work. Perfect means there's nothing left to do. The only way to be perfect is to never mess up and then die, which, if you're paying attention, is not how we define life. It doesn't work that way. Perfection is our way, hopefully, bottomlessly, living out this curse where we believe if I can just achieve this, then God will finally approve of me and unfold his arms, where daddy maybe will do the same, where my husband or my wife or my lack thereof will finally find me lovable and respectable. If I can just perfect, if I could just arrive. It's a curse. And here's the thing, is many of us, we think perfection is what God wants from us. And to the extent you're not perfect, you're going to suffer eternally. It haunts us. It dogs us. God has never asked for perfection. That's God's job. This is what we do, is we confuse perfect and holy. But holy doesn't mean perfect. Holy means set apart. It means different. It doesn't mean better or worse. It doesn't mean condescending. It means here's how society is moving, and I am coming to a point where I recognize it's blind, it's foolish, and destructive in some measure. And not because I'm better, but because I want to live, I'm going to follow life himself. That's what makes you holy. It doesn't perfect you. It puts you behind perfection. It's reconciliation. Don't confuse perfection and holiness. That's what religion does. Religion insecurely and anxiously tries to perfect itself and perfect itself and perfect itself until it is all it thinks about, to the exclusion of others. And one day you wake up, whether you're a religion or an individual, you wake up and you go, oh my God, I use people. I push people away that stain my quest for perfection. I'm nicer to people who enhance my life. I use people because I'm trying to perfect my universe. Oh my God, I'm covered with leaves and I have no fruit. This isn't something that evil religion does. This is something that people do when they misunderstand what the creator of all things wants. Perfection is not your job. Your job is reconciliation. Forgive yourself for being a human. And forgive others for their humanity. Because you could get it all right. You could have all faith. You can move a mountain. And if you don't have love, who cares? Least of all the Christ that withers the fig tree and the temple and invites you down the road. I don't know where this hits you. And I don't know how you're going to interact with this. But maybe asking yourself and some others some questions. Like, am I trying to raise perfect kids because it's a reflection on my perfection? Am I using my children to make myself lovable? Am I trying to earn a degree because I want to know how to do what I'm passionate about well? Or do I have something to prove to the world or to my world about my lovability and my being respectful? Because you understand, if you keep inwardly focusing, trying to perfect yourself, you'll have leaves and no fruit, and you're already dying. You can never achieve perfection it just grows and grows and grows into a selfish thing that even in the face of Isaiah 56 can say, we use people. We don't even recognize that they're people anymore. We're so inwardly focused. And Jesus says, you're dead. My prayer for each of us is that we would be bold enough to ask questions about the difference between looking alive and actually interacting with others and participating in the ministry of reconciliation. That we wouldn't become hyper-spiritual, that we would simply forgive people for being different and hurtful and wrong, and that we would forgive ourselves for our imperfections, that we would embrace that I'm a human being and perfection and humanity don't really go together. And that maybe holiness is different than perfection. Maybe holiness is just choosing to follow life himself for sanity, for wakefulness, for seeing. May we be bold enough to ask those questions of each other and be different as we walk behind the Christ. See you next week.